Shalom, everybody, and we welcome you to this week's 5-Minute Update, where we examine the news from the past week and correlate it to major Bible prophecies of the end of days, where we focus on the prophecies that the nations will divide the land of Israel and the city of Jerusalem. This will result in the judgment of the nations. The judgment of nations is war between the nations and worldwide economic collapse. From war between the nations and worldwide economic collapse, the world will reorganize and form one world government with one world currency. That is the fulfillment of Revelation in chapter 13. The duration of time of one world government is 3.5 years before the Messiah Yeshua sets his feet down on the Mount of Olives. At this time, while the nations are being judged and we have economic collapse, the God of Israel will gather his people from the nations where they've been scattered and unite the 12 tribes of Israel, ending their exile. And this process will be miraculous. It will be greater than the miracles of the children of Israel who came out of Egypt. And through this event, Yeshua, the Messiah, will be glorified. And so we're looking at current events to see how close we may be to the possible fulfillment of these prophetic events that are associated with the tribulation. And I have some very significant prophetic news to share with you this week in the update. And Israel and the Palestinians have agreed to direct talks. These will take place on September the 2nd in the United States in Washington, D.C. Now, the issues that were surrounding bringing together these direct talks were Israel wanted to have the direct talks, but they did not want to have any preconditions regarding the direct talks. In other words, they did not want to be committed before the talks started to a Palestinian state based upon 67 borders and making East Jerusalem as the capital of that Palestinian state. They didn't want, before the talks started, to be committed to a specific time frame to wrap up all the outstanding issues. Meanwhile, the Palestinians did want preconditions. They did want a commitment from the United States and the international community that if they would enter into direct talks, they would be based on a specific time frame with a specific goal and purpose, and that is to create a Palestinian state based upon 67 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital. So the United States, especially the Obama administration, they wanted these direct talks to happen real badly. And I believe, for those of you who've been following the 5-Minute Update, especially this year since the spring, I believe that the Obama administration laid out a plan where they desired to get to direct talks right at this time of the year. And there was an agreement in the spring that there would be up to 4 months of indirect talks. Now, those talks started on May the 9th, which means exactly 4 months later would be September the 9th. But I believe the plan was that before those indirect talks ended, that the United States wanted the parties to go to direct talks. And I believe the reason for doing so is the Obama administration wants to put incredible pressure upon Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu to make an agreement on the borders of a Palestinian state prior to the November elections. And in order to get the biggest benefit from that possibly happening, according to U.S. politics, then the most opportune time to get that agreement for momentum regarding the November midterm elections would be sometime in September or October. And ultimately, another reason why the United States targeted direct talks at this time is, I believe, that through the direct talks, they could force the view of Benjamin Netanyahu, whether he really has been bluffing when he's been saying that he's in favor of peace talks, in favor of a Palestinian state, if he's really serious about negotiating, making Jerusalem an international city, or this was all political maneuvering by him, and he wasn't going to be forced to know which one this actually is unless he had direct talks. And so if he really is serious, then there's going to get there's going to be an agreement on the borders of a Palestinian state, which the timing of it will benefit the Obama administration. But if if Netanyahu is bluffing, then the wrath of the international community could come against Israel, and the threat could be made for Israel to be isolated from the international community. And there was also a threat made in the spring that the United States would be willing to recognize through the UN Security Council a Palestinian state and the borders thereof. So those are all the issues surrounding this week's events. And so in order to be able to bring Israel and the Palestinians together, given that one, that is Israel, was against preconditions and the Palestinians had preconditions in order to agree to the direct talks, what the United States decided to do is that the United States would issue an announcement inviting Israel to the direct talks without making any mention of preconditions, so that Israel can say that we have agreed to direct talks on our terms without preconditions. And the reason why Israel has been so adamant about this position is if Israel would agree to preconditions before the talks, it would put Israel in a bad negotiating position. Also, it would harm the possibility of maintaining Netanyahu's government, that there may be those within his coalition who would decide to topple his government. So politically, Israel needed that point of view. And so Hillary Clinton, she made an announcement for an invitation to the direct talks, not making mention of any preconditions. As a result of that, Israel agreed to come to the direct talks, stating that they were accepting the invitation based upon no preconditions. However, the quartet, which consists of the United States, the European Union, Russia, and the United Nations, they made their own statement that endorsed a Palestinian state based upon 67 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital and a one-year time frame to conclude all issues regarding a peace agreement. And it was on the basis of the quartet statement that the Palestinians agreed to come to the direct talk. So since the United States made their invitation, and because the United States is a member of the quartet, in essence, the United States sent out two messages that were contrary to each other in order to accomplish their political goals, that is, desiring direct talks, desiring an agreement for a Palestinian state based upon 67 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital. So that's the politics that surrounds the news articles, which I'm going to be now sharing with you wherein there has been an agreement now to start direct talks in the United States in Washington, D.C. on September the 2nd. Now, that agreement is huge prophetically because we're looking at the possibility that the tribulation can start this year. And in order for that to be possible, there needs to be direct talks, because without direct talks, there can't be an agreement on the borders of a Palestinian state. So these direct talks make the start of the tribulation in 2010 possible. Now, whether they'll yield any results, we have to wait and see. But already a crisis regarding the talks is developing, and they haven't even officially started yet, because September 26th is the deadline for the 10-month freeze on building in the West Bank, which the Netanyahu government announced last year. And the Palestinians have already said that they will not continue direct talks if Israel announces that they will continue building from the 10-month freeze. And so that crisis will be upon us in the next month, and it will have consequences whatever Israel decides. So let's begin sharing with you the article, since I've now given you a preview of what the articles are going to tell us. From the Jerusalem Post, August the 20th, the headline is, Clinton announces direct talks to resume on September the 2nd. Direct talks between Israel and the Palestinians are set to begin at the beginning of September, and within a year should lead to the resolution of all final status issues, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced on Friday. Clinton said she had invited Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas to Washington on September the 2nd to relaunch direct negotiation to resolve all final status issues, which we believe can be completed within 1 year. Now, they probably do need a year to resolve all final status issues, but they may not need a year. They may only need a couple months to just get an agreement on borders only. The article continues and says, Netanyahu and Abbas are expected to first meet individually with U.S. President Barack Obama on September the 1st, when Obama will hold bilateral meetings with King Abdullah of Jordan and Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, topped off by a dinner for all four that night. Clinton, who will preside over the trilateral meeting the next day, said that the negotiations themselves would start with no preconditions. That was to satisfy Israel. They are due to be held in various places, that is, after the initial meeting in Washington, that is to be worked out, including times in the region itself. These negotiations should take place without preconditions and be characterized by good faith and commitment to their success. Those words are meant to tell Israel that they should be coming to the direct talks based upon seeking to work out an agreement for a Palestinian state. Israel has insisted that there be no preconditions to the talks, which have been held up, which has held up Palestinian participation, as the Palestinians have made demands ranging from a total settlement freeze, including building over the Green Line in Jerusalem, to talks from where they broke off under the previous Israeli premier, to Israel agreeing to using the 67 borders as the basis of negotiations. Though none of these demands were met by Clinton's characterizations, the Palestinians did get the short time frame through the statement of the quartet, that is a one-year period that they had been seeking. Though Netanyahu has said that talks could conclude quickly, Israel has resisted any deadlines on the process. U.S. Middle East envoy George Mitchell, who spoke to reporters following Clinton's announcement, declined to describe the one-year time frame as a deadline when was pressed regarding that issue. Asked specifically whether it was a deadline, Mitchell responded, "We believe it can be done within a year, and that is our objective." He also said that the terms of reference would be sorted out by the participating parties, despite Palestinian desires that there be firm terms of reference for the negotiations. Only the party themselves can determine the terms of reference and the basis for negotiations. They will do so when they meet and discuss these matters, Mitchell said, indicating that applied to the sequencing of final status issues as well. All permanent status issues will be on the table. It will be for the parties themselves to decide the manner in which they will be addressed. Mitchell did, however, say that the U.S. would be ready to provide proposals if it was necessary. "We will be active and sustained partners," he said. "As necessary and appropriate, we will offer bridging proposals, but I repeat, this is a direct bilateral negotiation between the parties with our assistance and with the assistance of our friends and allies." The quartet, consisting of the U.S., the European Union, the United Nations, and Russia, made a statement Friday that provided some of the framework sought by the Palestinians. In endorsing direct talks, the quartet expressed support for the pursuit of a just, lasting, and comprehensive regional peace as envisioned in the Madrid Terms of Reference, the Security Council resolutions, and the Arab Peace Initiative. Those documents, though, are filled with configurations that Israel has objected to. While Israel embraced Clinton's announcement, it has remained silent on the quartet statement, with which it has reservations. So, based upon Clinton's statement and offer to have direct talks with no preconditions, Israel accepted the offer. From the Jerusalem Post, August the 20th, Netanyahu welcomes U.S. announcement to start talks. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu welcomed Friday an announcement made by the U.S. to resume direct negotiations with the Palestinians without prerequisites. Netanyahu said he was satisfied with the U.S. clarification that the negotiations will take place without prior condition, and added that Israel wants serious and comprehensive talks. Reaching in a peace agreement is a difficult challenge, but it is possible, Netanyahu said. Next, I would like to read to you the statement that was put out by the quartet. And this statement that I'm reading to you comes from the U.S. Department of State website. The statement reads, "The representatives of the quartet reaffirm their strong support for direct negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians to resolve all final status issues. The quartet reaffirms its full commitment to its previous statements, including in Trieste on the 26th of June 2009, in New York, and on the 24th of September 2009, as well as its statement in Moscow on 19th of March 2010, which provides the direct bilateral negotiations that resolve all final status issues that should lead to a settlement negotiated between the parties that ends the occupation that began in 1967 and results in the emergence of an independent, democratic, and viable Palestinian state living side by side in peace and security with Israel and its other neighbors. The quartet expresses its determination to support the parties throughout the negotiations, which can be completed within 1 year, and the implementation of an agreement. The quartet again calls on both sides to observe calm and restraint and to refrain from provocative actions and inflammatory rhetoric. Now, a provocative action would be an announcement to resume building in the West Bank. The statement goes on to say, "Welcoming the result of the Arab Peace Initiative Committee in Cairo on July the 29th, the quartet notes that success will require sustained regional and international support for the negotiations in the parallel process of Palestinian state building in the pursuit of a just, lasting, and comprehensive regional peace as envisioned in the Madrid Terms of Reference, Security Council resolutions, and the Arab Peace Initiative. The Quartet Principles intends to meet with their colleagues from the Arab League in September in New York to review the situation. Accordingly, the Quartet calls on the Israelis and the Palestinians to join in launching direct negotiations on September 2nd in Washington, D.C. to resolve all final status issues and fulfill the aspirations of both parties. That is the statement. So that statement clearly, in making reference to the things that it did, meaning the Arab Peace Initiative, Security Council resolutions, the statements that were made by the Quartet statement says a peace agreement based upon 67 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital, with the end to Israeli settlements in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. That is the meaning of that statement. Now, the United States is a member of the Quartet, and the United States agrees with the statements of the Quartet that it has made previously. So this statement reaffirms previous statements. So in essence, the United States is saying that these negotiations will be based upon the preconditions of a Palestinian state based upon 67 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital. And so as a result of that statement, the Palestinians had a meeting and they agreed to accept the invitation by the Quartet for direct talks, and said that their coming to the direct talks was based upon the statement of the Quartet. So the Jerusalem Post, August the 20th, the headline reads, the Palestinians say direct talks to resume according to the Quartet statement. In reaction to the announcement made by U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to resume direct negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians, Palestinian Authority negotiator Saab Erekat said Friday that he hoped the Quartet and others would work diligently to ensure the one-year time frame for talks is reached and press Israel to end its provocative acts. Palestinian Liberation Organization leaders gathered overnight Friday and voted to accept the U.S. invitation, according to senior Palestinian official Yasser Abed Rabo. The PLO Executive Committee announces its acceptance of a resumption of direct negotiations with Israel in accordance with the statement made by the International Mideast Quartet in the invitation by the United States. Members of the committee warned that Israel will put direct talks at a serious risk if it resumes building settlements, Israel Radio reported early Saturday. The Quartet of the U.S., the United Nations, European Union, and Russia made a statement Friday that provided some of the framework sought by the Palestinians. In endorsing direct talks, the Quartet expressed support for the pursuit of a just, lasting, and comprehensive regional peace as envisioned in the Madrid Terms of Reference, Security Council resolutions, and the Arab Peace Initiative. Those documents, though, are filled with things that Israel has objected to in going to direct talks. According to Israel Radio, the Quartet demands a total commitment by Israel to end settlement building. While Israel embraced Clinton's announcement, it has remained silent on the Quartet statement, with which it has reservations. Now, the purpose of stating it has reservations about the Quartet is for internal Israeli politics, that Netanyahu can't just openly say, oh yeah, I'm agreeing to direct talks and this is what I'm committing to, because it will mean that he's given up any negotiating position. It means that he must end settlement construction, which means that he could see the collapse of his government. And so when he says that they're entering direct talks, but they're really ignoring the Quartet statements, practically speaking, Israel cannot ignore the Quartet statements, especially since the United States has said multiple times they do agree with that Quartet statement. So the controversy of Zion now, with the start of the direct talks, is upon us. Crisis upon Israel to make very important decisions is upon Israel. And namely, what are they going to do come September 26 regarding these settlements? Because politically, Israel cannot say, oh, we're going to continue building, allow the talks to collapse. It is not acceptable to the United States and the European Union. So now we have Fatah, of which Mahmoud Abbas leads, of the Palestinian Authority, agreeing to direct talks, but the other Palestinian factions do not agree to the direct talks. And they have signed documents indicating that they are not in favor of the direct talks. So, from the EpicTimes.com, August the 17th, the headline is Hamas and Palestinian groups refuse direct talks. Hamas and 10 other Palestinian organizations said on Sunday in Damascus, Syria, that they do not support resuming direct talks between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. The Islamic Jihad, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, among other Palestinian groups, were among those that signed a statement saying that they were not in favor of direct talks. So now the position of the Palestinians is such that given they've agreed to direct talks, if it does not yield results, meaning a Palestinian state based upon 67 borders, the Palestinians, Mahmoud Abbas, will have problems internally himself with other Palestinian groups, including Hamas, that is not in favor of direct talks, that does not believe it will result in a Palestinian state. And these other groups are in favor of doing whatever they can to not make the talks that they would yield a Palestinian state. And they prefer to go to war with Israel rather than seeing the direct talks and seeing those talks go forward. And so that's the political situation among the Palestinian entities. So this next article from Ynet News, August the 19th, and these next few articles I'm going to be sharing with you is, while there is now an agreement for direct talks to start for the purpose of agreeing to a Palestinian state, at the same time, there is a great chance that war could break out in the region, and especially in the north of Israel with Syria, Hezbollah, coordinating war with Hamas, that they are prepared to go to war any day. So the next few articles address these issues. So from Ynet News, the headline is, Arab terrorists are preparing war with Israel. Hezbollah built an elaborate network of tunnels that will allow its members to fight a future war against Israel without being exposed to Israel Air Force bombardments and Israeli surveillance, a Kuwaiti newspaper says. According to a report published by the Kuwaiti newspaper, the tunnel network is more impressive than the Paris Underground, but I believe that's probably referring to World War I or World War II, and is meant to prevent the IDF from gravely hurting Hezbollah by aerial or ground attacks. The report also claimed Hezbollah created an underground system of weapon caches and that additional warehouses were dispersed in different locations above ground so they are not damaged by Israel attacks, as was the case during the second Lebanon War, which happened in 2006. So because of these things, if there is an attack against Israel from the north, In order for Israel to protect itself, quite conceivably, Israel will have to take out Damascus, which if they do, would be a fulfillment of Isaiah in chapter 17. The next article is from Debka File, August the 20th. According to Arab sources, a major military attack against Israel is close. War preparations are reported by Debka File's military sources in Iran and Syria. Debka File's military sources report. In Iran, Iran's Revolutionary Guard announced on Friday, August the 20th, that the IRGC is in full readiness to encounter firmly with the stupidity of the U.S. and the Zionist regime. In Syria, Prime Minister Najee al-Attari gathered his ministers and heads of security and emergency services Thursday and ordered them to place all their services on immediate war readiness. And sources close to the Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas quoted him as saying that direct talks with Israel were not going to produce anything because a big military surprise awaits the Middle East. On Thursday, too, Iran pitched its threat level high by warning that any attack on Iran's nuclear sites would be met by the IRGC's targeting the interests of the enemies in any part of the world. In the United States, respected commentators this week talked and wrote openly about a possible war over Iran's progress toward a nuclear bomb capability. Former U.S. Ambassador to Israel Martin Indyk, who has excellent connections in the likely than Israel to launch an attack on Iran. Lawrence Eagleburger, former U.S. Secretary of State, had this to say about the activation of Iran's first reactor set to happen today. That's August the 21st. The world's going to war over this. If Iran gets the weapon, it's going to use it. He urged an attack on Iran before it obtained a bomb. And so quite possibly the scenario that's perhaps being laid out is that once we have the start of direct talks on September the 2nd, if in the ensuing weeks, if Israel does not agree to extend the settlement freeze in the West Bank, that the forces in the north, Hezbollah, Syria, and then Hamas, may decide to say, see, Israel's not serious about negotiations, and they will then go to war, launch an attack against Israel. But if Israel agrees to extend the settlement free, under the banner of the 2008
process. I just stole the mic. Oh, he just realized it.
For those of you who are listening to through recording, we had some Pal Talk problems here, so let me continue. It says clarity on negotiations. This is the viewpoint of Benny Begin. Under the banner of the 2008 Annapolis process, the Israeli government and the PLO leadership failed to reach a lasting agreement. According to Mahmoud Abbas, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert proposed that Israel withdraw from 98% of the total territory in the West Bank and the Gaza. Actually, the deal encompassed 100% because the balance was to be swapped with some territory from inside the state of Israel proper. Olmert also proposed a safe passage between Gaza and the West Bank under Israeli sovereignty. According to Abbas, he also agreed that Israel recognized in principle the so-called right of return. Ulmer denies that he did this. But we had articles early in the year that we read that Ulmer actually admitted that he did do it. However, he did propose that thousands of Arab refugees be allowed to come into Israel on a humanitarian basis. As for Jerusalem, Ulmer proposed the dividing of the city into two parts. The neighborhoods populated by Arabs would become a part of the capital of a Palestinian Arab sovereign state. The Jewish neighborhoods would be retained under Israeli sovereignty. In addition, he proposed that Israel relinquish its sovereignty over the Temple Mount, the Mount of Olives, and the City of David, referred to by some as the Holy Basin. Israel's rule of these areas would be replaced by a consortium that would administer them, comprising of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, the United States, the PLO, and Israel. This far-reaching proposal by Ulmer addressing borders, refugees, and Jerusalem was declined by the PLO. Abbas was asked in a Washington Post interview in May 2008 why he had declined Ulmer's proposal, and his answer was the gaps were too wide. This truthfully reflects the situation because from the PLO point of view, the gaps were indeed still wide. During the negotiations of the Annapolis process, which was in 2007, the PLO leadership was asked whether once an agreement was reached to the liking of both parties, if it would agree to include an article stating that this agreement puts an end to the conflict and concludes all claims by the parties. That question was answered in the negative. Why would Ulmer's proposal still leave wide gaps so as to be unacceptable from the point of view of the PLO leadership only a year or so ago? The answer is that the PLO does not accept a situation of shared sovereignty in Jerusalem over the Temple Mount and its surroundings. Its goal is to have an Arab-Palestinian-Muslim sovereignty at the site. This is not just a whim of the current Palestinian leadership. In 2000, Prime Minister Ehud Barak proposed that Israel relinquish its rule over the upper part of the Temple Mount to Arab-Palestinian sovereignty, and that the lower part of the Temple Mount would be retained under Israeli sovereignty, but that was refused. The PLO assertion was that the whole Temple Mount should be under Arab-Muslim sovereignty. The reason for this has been well explained by the PLO leadership, which is considered to be the moderate faction within the Palestinian camp. It actually denies the undeniable by saying that there is no historic connection between the Jewish people and the Temple Mount, that the stories about two Jewish temples destroyed 2,600 and 2,000 years ago is a fairy tale. And that is the statement that Yasser Arafat made to President Clinton. Its basic tenet is that there is no Jewish connection to Jerusalem. Of course, this also relates to the West Bank, Gaza, the Galilee, and the Negev. For them, there is no historic Jewish connection to any of these places. The PLO leadership in this respect is consistent. This is its basic philosophy, and you will find its corollary in its adamant refusal to accept the state of Israel as a nation state of the Jewish people. It explains openly that for them, Judaism is not a nationality but a religion. Since Judaism is a religion, and since religions are not entitled to establish and maintain states of their own, then the state of Israel has no right to exist and they will not recognize it as such. A year ago, in August of 2009, the Fatah Congress in Bethlehem reaffirmed its platform, referring to Chapter 1 of its charter as the point of departure for its policy. Article 19 in Chapter 1 states, "Armed struggle is a strategy, not a tactic. The armed revolution of the Arab-Palestinian people is a crucial element in the battle for liberation for the elimination of the Zionist presence. This struggle will not stop until the Zionist entity is eliminated and Palestine is liberated." For Fatah, then, there is a Zionist entity, not the Jewish nation deserving its own and only sovereign state on earth. As long as this is left as something that cannot be changed and maybe needs to be changed, it will be there. Unless the leadership of our neighbors changes its view, very little will be achieved in the foreseeable future regarding a peace agreement between Jews and Arabs west of the Jordan River. Where is the agreement by the PLO to come to terms with the reality and agree in some way to the minimum requirements of any sober Israel faction in the Knesset? Abbas maintains that Olmert offered him in 2008. Too little. Foreign Minister Zippy Livni, the leader of the opposition, will tell you that Olmert offered him too much. Under this geometry, an agreement cannot be achieved unless the PLO leadership changes its mind. Unless people impress upon them that they should do so, I don't see a peace agreement happening, says Benny Begin. In June of 2009, the quartet issued a statement that for the first time included the political term two states for two peoples as a proposed solution. This is not my solution, but this is agreed to by the many, just not the PLO. The PLO leadership and activists never say that the solution entails two nations. However, in March 2010, in another quartet statement issued in Moscow, it mentions a two-state solution. Its mentioning of a two-state solution for two peoples vanished. It was made only of the Palestinian people without bringing up the Jewish people. What kind of a signal does that send? When people ask what the government of Israel can be expected to offer to the PLO, we may refer them to the fact that previous Israeli governments offered to relinquish the West Bank and Gaza and parts of Jerusalem to no avail. People must recognize this. The Palestinian leadership insists that negotiations now start at the point they had reached with Olmert at the end of 2008. That means they are not satisfied with what was put on the table a year ago. That means that they want more than that. So, in analyzing the situation, Benny Begin, who is a member of the inner cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu, a part of his group of seven, says, hey, previous Israeli governments made these far-reaching offers, and the Palestinians refused them. So, therefore, it's inconceivable to expect that they would agree to a Palestinian state offer by Israel this time as well, because their stated goal, as analyzed by Benny Begin, is not that they want a Palestinian state and to live side by side with Israel with peace and security. They want to eliminate all of Israel. So based upon that, Benny Begin does not see that an agreement on a Palestinian state is a viable, practical, and a realistic expectation. And so these are the articles now that explains the current situation with the peace process, that there now is scheduled direct talks for September the 2nd, while these talks are taking place, that there are preparations for war being made by Israel's neighbors and enemies. There is a crisis brewing come September the 26th, where the Israeli government must decide whether they're going to extend the freezing of building in the West Bank or not. The Obama administration would like to see an agreement on borders in September, October for the November elections. Meanwhile, we've shared with you in depth the politics that is surrounding all of this coming together in Israel, among the PLO, what the positions of the various parties are, how they see things, and why. So hopefully that's going to give you now a comprehensive perspective of the situation as we go forward with the talks. And now I'm going to share with you some articles regarding the situation with Iran. From Debka File, August the 16th, Vladimir Putin of Russia goes ahead with fueling up Iran's nuclear reactor today. That would be August the 20th. First, Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin decided it was safe to go ahead and loan Iran's first nuclear reactor with fuel on August the 21st, effectively making it active after Russia's weekend announcement of this intent seemed not to trouble the U.S. and Israel, Debka File sources in Moscow and Iran report. He decided the two governments had either been caught flat-footed or had come to terms with Russian-sponsored nuclear project that would allow Iran to produce weapons-grade plutonium. The impression Russian officials tried to convey that the reactor would only go on stream in late September was meant to deflect U.S. or Israeli pressure, which in the event was not forthcoming. August the 16th, therefore, Moscow further announced that Sergei Kiryenko, the head of Russian state nuclear cooperation, would visit the plant in Iran Friday, August the 20th, to see for himself how far the work on the 1200 to 1300 MWE reactor had progressed. He expects to be accompanied by Russian Energy Minister Sergei Shamatko. Moscow further disclosed it had guaranteed a 10-year supply of reactor fuel for the plant. On August the 21st, Ali Akbar Saliha, head of the Atomic Energy Organization in Iran, will join the Russian officials at a press conference to coincide with the transfer mark its effective inauguration. Saliha also announced that Iran would build another 10 installations for enriching uranium inside protective mountain caves, in addition to the 3 known facilities which brought Iran under U.S. and Western sanctions. Russian and Iranian officials are bending over backwards to assure the world that this plant is harmless and is a peaceful project for manufacturing electricity, whereas Debkafile has previously reported and American experts stressed Monday that once the fuel will produce plutonium-239, which can be used to make nuclear weapons. So in the starting up of this plant, the New York Times reports on August the 19th that the United States is assuring Israel that an Iran nuclear bomb threat is not imminent, and Iran could not have a bomb within the next year. The Obama administration, citing evidence of continued troubles inside Iran's nuclear program, has persuaded Israel that it would take roughly a year and perhaps longer for Iran to complete what one senior official called a dash for a nuclear weapon, according to American officials. Administration officials said they believe the assessment has dimmed the prospect that Israel would preemptively strike against the country's nuclear facilities within the next year, as Israeli officials have suggested in thinly veiled threats. For years, Israeli and American officials have debated whether Iran is on an inexorable drive toward a nuclear bomb, and if so, how long it would take to produce one. A critical question has been the time it would take Iran to convert existing stocks of low-enriched uranium into weapons-grade material, a process commonly known as breakout. Israeli intelligence officials had argued that Iran could complete such a race for the bomb in months, while American intelligence agencies had come to believe in the past year that the timeline is longer. We think that they have roughly a year dash time, said Gary Sumore, President Obama's top advisor on nuclear issues, referring to how long it would take the Iranians to convert nuclear material into a working weapon. A year is a very long period of time. American officials said the United States believed international inspectors would detect an Iranian move toward breakout within weeks, leaving a considerable amount of time for the United States and Israel to consider military strikes. Now, in either a behavior of anti-Semitism or a behavior that they expect war in, they don't want to see a decrease in the value of their stock holdings, Harvard University, in the second quarter of 2010, have sold all their Israeli stock holdings. So this is from the Globes online, globes.co.il, August the 15th. The headline is, Harvard University Fund sells all its Israeli holdings. In another blow to Israeli shares, the Harvard Management Company notified the U.S. Security and Exchange Commission on Friday that it had sold all of its holding in Israeli companies during the second quarter of 2010. No reason for the sale was mentioned. The Harvard Management Company manages Harvard's university. They have sold their holdings. That or it's a case of trying to show that they are anti-Israel. Now, normally when you sell the holdings, those who would have inside information, they probably wouldn't do it a week ahead of time. If they really have inside information, they'd do it 6 months to perhaps a year ahead of time. So they've already done it. They did it in the second quarter. So that could be a sign that there's an expectation of the U.S. and Israel going to war with Iran. Now, I read another article in the over the internet this week stating that the Israeli government was willing to wait to about December, that is the end of 2010, to see how the current sanctions against Iran, which were passed in June of this year, how they are coming along. If they're working, perhaps Israel may not be as interested in attacking Iran, but if they're clearly not working after 6 months, then the Israel would be very interested in looking to see whether it was time to attack Iran. And I believe this ultimately is the desirable view of the Obama administration. I do not believe that the Obama administration would like to go to war with Iran because of the uncertainty that would place in the economy and the minds of the American people, and also because the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have gone on for so long, and the American people are disappointed in the cost of the wars and how they are progressing. So I don't believe an attack on Iran would be helpful midterm elections for the Obama administration. They would carry too much risk, so they would prefer, I believe, to attack Iran after the November elections, possibly between the beginning of December to, let's say, the end of March. That would be more the desired time frame to launch an attack, and I believe that the U.S. wants to get Israel to agree to that type of a timing. Meanwhile, there is mention in the prophecies, Isaiah 17, war against Syria, that Damascus would cease to being a city. That is a tribulation event. It takes place in the day of the Lord. And then in Psalm chapter 83, it mentions the enemies that surround Israel, that it wants it to cease from being a nation. It implies the enemies are attacking Israel. Now, in Ezekiel 38 and 39, there's an attack upon Israel from the north. So, definitely there cannot be any dispute that there is a high-level preparation for war in the region. Among Israel's immediate neighbors, that would be Hezbollah, Syria, Lebanon, Hamas, as well as Iran ready to engage in the war. So the question is this one big war? Isaiah 17, Psalm 83, war with Iran, is that Ezekiel 38, 39, is that all one big war? Or are they a series of wars? For example, is the military buildup in the north, is that Isaiah 17, is it Psalm 83? And is that separate from war with Iran. Isaiah 13 says Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, Isaiah 13, 19, will be in a war with Persia or the Medes, Isaiah 13, 17, which is repeated in Jeremiah in chapter 51, verses 11 through 15. And so, is this all one war, or is this separate? And is Babylon in war with the Medes, is that separate from Ezekiel 38, 39? Is that separate from Damascus being destroyed and ceasing from being a city? And inevitably, we are going to have war in the next year, sometime in the next 12 months. It's almost inevitable that we're going to have war. We could have it as soon as this week. It may be delayed till the winter or maybe the spring. But I cannot see that it would go 12 months without some type of war in the region. So what would these wars be prophetically? I do believe that they would be connected and associated with tribulation events. Exactly what tribulation events, we only have to wait until the wars happen. Then we'll be able to know which prophecy or prophecies it fulfills. So what I want you to understand in this update is not only is there a peace process going on, which the prophecy says they're in agreement, by the nations to divide the land and the city of Jerusalem. There is at the same time the nations arming for war. And the two are related because the dividing of the land brings about war between the nations. And the war between the nations results in worldwide economic. It is through this process that we're able to get to one world government. And it's in this and through these events where the God of Israel gathers the exiles, unites the 12 tribes, and Messiah is glorified. Now the next article I have to share with you is a Big Brother article. I usually don't share a whole lot on Big Brother because there's plenty of sources out there where you can follow what Big Brother is doing. But this is from Cleveland.com. And it's an article stating that they are going to be putting in place in Cleveland, Ohio, that Cleveland trash cans and trash pickup, that the trash cans are going to have RFID chip that will be able to monitor the activity of the trash cans, and that if people don't properly recycle, that from the evidence from the RFID hang out in Cleveland's trash cans, but the city plans to sort through curbside trash to make sure residents are recycling and fine them $100 if they don't. The move is a part of a high-tech collection system the city will roll out next year with new trash and recycling carts embedded with radio frequency identification chips and barcodes. The chips will allow city workers to monitor how often residents roll carts to the curb for collection. If a chip shows a recyclable cart hasn't been brought to the curb in weeks, a trash supervisor will sort through the trash for recyclables. Trash carts containing more than 10% recyclables would lead to a $100 fine, according to Waste Collection Commissioner Roddy Owens. Recyclables include glass, metal cans, plastic bottles, paper, and cardboard. The chip-embedded carts are just starting to catch on elsewhere. The Washington, D.C. suburb of Alexandria, Virginia, earlier this year announced it would issue carts to check whether people are recycling. And I have two more articles to conclude the update. The first one is from Time.com, and it's the results of a Time poll that... This Time poll reveals that 24% of Americans believe that Obama is a Muslim. And the press is stating that this is not true. the press is stating that Obama is a Christian. Now, the issue about whether Obama is a Christian or a Muslim, if you want to research it more, just go to YouTube and look up the issue and examine for yourself your own evidence. But we've now have up to 24% of Americans do believe that he's a Muslim. Less than half of Americans believe that he is a Christian. Could that be because Obama doesn't attend weekly church services in Washington, D.C., because he is a promoter of Islamic holidays? He invites Islamic religious leaders to the White House. He promotes the building of an Islamic mosque in Ground Zero. Could these be some of the reasons why the American people believe that he is a Muslim? And the last article I'd like to share with you is a comment from the Washington Times. And this editorial is written by Jeffrey Kuhner. And he writes about, and the topic of his article is Obama's Islamic agenda. It appeared on August the 19th in the Washington Times. President Obama has revealed his true nature. After 20 months in the Oval Office, he still remains a largely unknown figure. A picture is coming into focus now, and it should trouble all Americans. It is widely known that Mr. Obama is a post-national progressive. Post-national means that he's not looking out for the historical interests of the United States. Progressive means that he's an advocate of socialism. Yet, he is also a cultural Muslim who is promoting an unity center and mosque just two blocks away where the Twin Towers were destroyed and nearly 3,000 Americans were murdered on September 11, 2001. He later tried to back away from these comments. Mr. Obama said he was defending the right of religious freedom, but not the wisdom of erecting the mosque. Nonetheless, Mr. Obama has made clear, in his view, the Ground Zero Mosque should be built. There was no good practical reason even to comment on the issue. He had been silent for weeks as the controversy gathered steam. The overwhelming majority of the American people opposed the mosque, especially the families of September 11th victims. Politically, it is a loser for him and his party. Yet, he could not keep his mouth shut. Why? Here's the answer, according to Jeffrey Kuhner. For Mr. Obama, defending Islam has been a key priority of his presidency. In his famous speech in Cairo, Mr. Obama apologized to the Muslim world for alleged sins and mistakes of America, even though no country has done more to liberate Islamic peoples than the United States, including campaigns in Bosnia, Kosovo, and Iraq. His aim was to engage the Islamic world on its terms and norms rather than defend America's values and national interests. Mr. Obama openly bragged about his Muslim background and that his family had followers of Islam. He spoke of his youth in Indonesia, his study of the Quran, and the call to Islamic prayer. In short, he discovered his inner Muslim in an attempt to ingratiate himself with the Arab street. The mastermind of the September 11th attacks be tried in civilian court with the full legal and constitutionary protections given to the United States citizens, several blocks from the World Trade Center site. He has ordered the words Muslim extremist, Islamic terrorist, and jihad be cleansed from national security documents. He is openly anti-Israel, and he is prematurely withdrawing combat troops from Iraq, threatening to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Israeli military and intelligence officials concede that the administration, through diplomatic back channels, had told Jerusalem that the United States will not bomb Iran's nuclear facilities. The Jews are on their own in confronting the Holocaust-denying dictator, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Mr. Obama's tepid sanctions has failed to curb Iran, a relentless march toward acquiring the nuclear bomb. This weekend, the Iranian nuclear power plant at Bushehr will begin to deal with religious freedom or tolerance. There is more than 1,200 mosques in America and dozens of them in New York City. The debate is about the meaning and memory of September 11th attacks. Those on the left, led by Mr. Obama, have been determined to alter the nature of that event. For them, it was simply a criminal act by several deranged individuals linked to a tiny group called Al-Qaeda. Instead, the September attacks were acts of war in which 19 Muslim hijackers in the name of radical Islam brought global jihad here on American soil. That is why the Ground Zero Mosque is so offensive. It will be a symbol of radical Islam's conquest of America. If Islamists can erect a monument of victory that will permanently loom over most our hallowed ground, what can't they do? It will signify the surrender of liberal multiculturalism to the forces of political Islam. That is why so many Americans are passionately opposed to the mosque. They realize what is at stake. A more probing analysis reveals the dangers we are courting. It is remarkable that our liberal court elites refuse to demand an investigation into Imam Faisal Abdul Raf, the cleric spearheading the Cordoba House Initiative, or his dubious and murky sources of funding. Even in Obama's nation, $100 million for a mosque is not chump change. Moderate. He is not some Muslim Gandhi preaching the virtues of multi-religious tolerance. Rather, he demands that America adopt Sharia law. He has said that U.S. policies were an accessory to the September 11th attacks. In other words, we brought it upon ourselves. He openly defends Hamas. Now he is on a State Department-sponsored trip across the Middle East, likely raising money for the mosque from rich Persian Gulf states such as Saudi Arabia. Mr. Obama has much to say when it comes to defending the rights of Muslims in America, even if it means supporting a project that deeply offends the values of Americans, disgraces the honor and memory of those who died on September the 11th, and bolsters a pro-Sharia militant imam. But he is strangely silent about the rampant persecution of Christians and Jews in Muslim-majority nations, especially in Saudi Arabia, which likely will provide the bulk of the financing for the Ground Zero Mosque, where churches and synagogues are banned. Across Europe and Canada, a stealth scheme of progressive multiculturalism with its moral relativism, radical secularism, hatred for the Judeo-Christian heritage, and a loathing of Western civilization, Islamism is filling the void. The great irony is that the First Amendment was aimed at preventing the state's establishment of religion. The Saudis have turned it upon its head. Riyadh, by financing mosques like the one at Ground Zero, is erecting radical Muslim sects here in the United States soil that ultimately may threaten our most cherished freedoms. For the Saudi regime, there is no separation of mosque and state, and is gradually imposing its theocratic will, its Islamic agenda, based on Sharia law, upon the West. In light of this, Mr. Obama is a self-conscious radical who is now putting the interests of Islam ahead of our own country. The debate about the Ground Zero Mosque has unmasked him as a president who favors Muslim interests over those of the American people. Who is Jeffrey Kuhner, the writer of this article? He's a columnist at the Washington Times and a president at the Edmund Burke Institute, a Washington think tank. He is the daily host of The Kuhner Show on WTNT 570 AM from 5 to 7 p.m. Well, that concludes this very important and significant update this week, where we see the great advance of events that are leading to the fulfillment of prophecies that are associated with the tribulation. That is, dividing the land of Israel, the city of Jerusalem, war between the nations, economic collapse, wherein the God of Israel will gather the 12 tribes of Israel, Messiah will be glorified. And so this is how close we are to being able to affirm that we would be indeed in the tribulation. Well, I pray that this five-minute update has been a blessing to you. For those of you who are listening to the update via recording and who tune in on Paltalk and listen to the update live, there is now a new time for the Beit Yaakov Hebraic Congregation Paltalk Room on Saturdays. The new time from which the update will be broadcast live is 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Central, noon Mountain, and 11 a.m. Pacific. I'm also going to be going on a speaking tour the first part of September. I'll be in the Tampa area, and then we will be in Texas in Abilene on September the 8th. We will be in Greenville, Texas, in the Dallas area, September the 9th. Waco, September the 10th and 11th. And we'll finish up in Tulsa on September the 12th. So if you're in those areas and you're interested in coming to these meetings, remember that Sukkot is coming up, and we would encourage you to attend one of many Sukkot sites around the country. I personally will, the first couple of days of Sukkot, will be speaking. The first few days of Sukkot, the first weekend of Sukkot at the Seasons of Our Joy in Lake of the Ozarks in central Missouri. Then I'll be going on and will be at the Lion and Lamb Sukkot in Chandler, Oklahoma for the remaining part of the Sukkot holiday. So we pray that we'll get to see you somewhere, either in the meetings or at Sukkot. Meanwhile, we pray that you're enjoying this five-minute update, that it's a blessing to you. It helps you to be able to follow the news, have analysis from them from a Hebraic perspective, so that you can be prepared for the days and the times in which we are living. Until we do it again, shalom. In Yeshua the Messiah, Amen.